This is take number two, side number one, of the interview with Glenn Bjork, taking place on June 23rd, 1994. My name is Mary Tippett Andes, and as we finished at the end of side one, Mr. Bjork was clarifying for me a little bit more about the camelback, because I misunderstood that the camelback and the plate were on opposite sides of the car, but in fact that was incorrect, right?
Yeah, that's right. Those plates are on it. One is on the car, and one is on the camelback. So the plate that's on the car rides under the plate on the camelback, so that when the car starts dumping, it won't tip the whole car in the trench. That holds it down. And that extra piece over the top of the camelback only allows that to go so high, a fifth wheel to go so high. So it only dumps, I suppose, about a 45, 50 degrees. So that's about, you can get that in your head. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is a little bit hard to explain to somebody.
Well, and I think, too, people who are looking for more information about how all of this is set up, they can go to the mining museum and see some of the exhibits,
that's
and
true.
That will clarify that.
No, this here, the camelback setup, worked good for many years. The motor man stayed right on the motor and pulled them cars over. But unfortunately, one day, a guy had his leg caught in between the camelback and the motorman. He run the motor. And I think he had it amputated, or was it that bad? Next to amputate. So then they start pulling it over with an electric tugger. That's a tugger. Electric tuggers will pull the ore and rock. Well, and when you're mining, that cleans out the ore from where you blasted. You've probably heard of electric tugger. I know it. But yeah, so then they hooked a chain. They had an endless cable down between the tracks. They hook a ring on the front of the motor, and then they push the handle, and nobody on the motor pulled the car to go over the camelback. So nobody could get hurt, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm fairly familiar with what an electric tugger is, but I would like to put that information on the tape if you would explain what a tugger is.
A tugger is a machine that pulls the ore or rock, whatever you're mining, you drill and blast, and you've got to have a means of getting that rock out. So you put a head block, that's a big block where the cable goes through. We call it the breast, that's the final where you blasted. We drill eye pin holes or put a wooden pole, we used to call it a gin pole, make a little hitch in the ore, one on each side, we put a gin pole. We wedge it in tight. In fact, we make a pick a little hole in the breast, and then get a measurement back to the last set of timber or steel, and cut it on the bevel. So you drive that in tight and spike it. Then you throw a chain over there, gin pole, with a choker ring on it, and so the tighter you pull it, it stay tight, you know. And your block was hung from that.
Block being a large pulley?
Yeah, a large pulley, yeah. Well, anyway, that's how you got your dirt out of the out of your drift, is by using your stugger. It was a cable, a pull-back cable and a pull-in cable. One handle you push on the tugger, pull the scraper in. And, of course, you release that one and push the other one, and now it haul that scraper in with the load. And you either dump down, or depending on where you're mining, you would dump down a raise or a dump right into a car on the level. But yeah, there was a lot of changes in them tuggers too. I think they were about 15 horse tugger when I started in the mine. My gosh, they got up to 60 horse, more powerful tuggers. Yeah.
How were they operated, pneumatically or electric?
Electric. Those were electric. All and electric motors on them, yeah. And they were. And then they had gears. They had like a transmission in between gears. And then your two drums. They had two drums. One drum wound up your pull rope, and one for your pull back rope. So you push the handle for a pull back, you would pull your scraper into the working. And then you let that go and push the other handle and pull the load back in.
And were the ropes really ropes, or were they cables?
Cables, yeah, we call them ropes. Yeah, they were steel cable, yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, when we were talking about the plat by the where the cage would stop on every level. You mentioned that there was concrete on the floor of the plat. What other places would there be concrete underground?
Well, where they put a dam. There was a case of need to seal off that main line in case they got a lot of water coming from somewhere. Well, they drill into the sides of the drift to make good anchor. And the same thing on the back, we call it the back, that's above. And drill eye pin holes down on the bottom end. And then you drill a lot of eye bolts in there to help to hold it along with that cutout. They blast in at 2-3 feet. And then they pour cement there, both sides, and over the top, and across the bottom. And then in that setup, they had big square timbers that were set up on top, over on the upper side of the dam. So if they had to, they could pull each timber down. They'd just drop into place. There was a kind of a channel iron on both sides where these timbers were set up here. You drop them in there, and boom, they all one on top of each other.
So like the same principle as a roll top desk, maybe, sort of?
Well, you could, I suppose, kind of classify a little bit, rougher than a roll top, but yeah, the timbers were there, and if you ever needed in a hurry, they could just drop some timbers down in there. Yeah, in case they got a flood or something. Now the whole dam was in concrete. You got a haul motors going through there, hauling ore. So it had to be open. But if you had to block off, then those timbers were there to block off.
Yeah. Now we're talking about concrete and the places that it was used. The setup where the Camelback was.
The skip side plat and the cage plat, they were all poured concrete floor. And on this piece in the middle here, I told you about, they poured up so far to reinforce that pillar so it wouldn't peel off, you know, keep peeling off. Well, then you wouldn't have no pillar left in time. Mm-hmm. Because that was really supporting. That'd be an awful wide place there. If you took that all out, you'd have about 60 feet of opening.
Now, when you're talking about the pillar also, it's really not a pillar in the traditional sense, but it's more like, is it more like a wall?
Yeah, it's a wall, really. But anything that supports them is a pillar. But it was called a pillar, but it was a wall, actually. Yeah. So it was wide there by the cage, and as you go in, it got narrower down to nothing. So then this tracks came out of the cage side and met up with the switch there with tracks going inside. So in other words, there was a switch here when Lord Ork and they had the right of way. It was always coming to the shaft to dump. This had a switch. If you want to come into the cage side, you had to throw a switch to come this way. But the main line, the haulage, that was always switch always for that, for the main line. Yeah.
And the switches, I understand, were never touched unless the dispatcher gave the okay to throw a switch.
Yes, that came in later, the dispatching, yeah. Each level had a dispatcher when I was there. But it all handled from surface then after. He didn't have to go underground even. He had a big board with all the prints of the levels and the cross cuts and yes. All done by one man. I guess it was a nut house from what I heard. You go cuckoo listening to all them motors. I never got in on that part. I did a little bit dispatching when 6th level had it, just for a short time, but I told Cap, I said, I got to get out of here. I couldn't sit.
I want to ask you a little bit about communication. During the different mines that you worked at, the Princeton mine and the Mather B, or the Mather A and the Mather B, if you needed to get information from one place in the mine to another, how would they do that? Start with the Princeton mine.
Well, actually, there at Princeton, you had a telephone on the plat. And that was all there was. If you wanted to get somebody, you took a mortar or had somebody bring you in, hurry up and get them.
Describe the telephone.
Well, it was a big iron box. It was underground, pretty well sealed from, it wouldn't get wet. And then you had a ringer, ring, with a little crank. You had a ring for oil shops or engine houses, services.
How would you direct a call to a specific place?
By different amount of rings. By different amount of rings. I don't remember what the rings were now, both engine house and all that. But anyway, matter A now. There was no dispatcher when I was at Matter A either. There was no dispatcher. That came in at the Matter B. Of course, Matter A had it too, I suppose, at the same time, but I had left there. But yeah, everything was handled, but they had radios on all the motors. And they could contact the motor anywhere where they were if they needed help or to dispatch them to another area or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the time that you were at the Matter A, which was until 1946, there was not
any... 47 out of Matter A, fall of 47.
47. Until 47 then at the Matter A, there weren't any kinds of communications that would go right up into the contracts or anything?
No. Well, if you want, if say mining gang was working up there, and if they happened to see the light, fine. But you had electricity up in the working places, and they had rigged up signal lights. So in other words, if you wanted to send timber up off a timber trunk, one guy'd lash on the timber, and you'd give two bells hoist up, two lights. Two lights would show up on top. Lights. Hoist up, he'd hoist up there, then he'd hoist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Three bells, send her down again. Yeah. Some of them raises were so high, it was hard to holler. You know, you had to have some kind of a communication that way, which they did, yeah, they had signal lights. Yeah.
Good. In the places that you worked with, what do you recall the longest, the highest raise being?
Well, Jimmy Baldini and I brought up a raise at the Matter B from the 9th to the 8th level. That's 225 feet. With a modern new device called the Alamac raise machine.
Can you spell that?
Alamac, or K, I forget. Alamac. That was devised and built by Swede engineers, and they were using them in Sweden. You got on this rig here, and you didn't have to climb the old conventional way of raising. You went up ladders, and you built a stage as two poles, and then you had stage plank, and then you drilled off of that your holes up, going up. And then after you're all drilled, then you go down and get your dynamite and your caps, and you go up and load them holes, and then climb back, hook up, and then come back down. And if you're using electric, you went to a switch box and threw a switch, and the caps would get energy. Or if you weren't too high, and years ago they didn't, before they had electric, they had lighting by a fuse, light fuses. And they had 8-foot fuses. And, or either 12-foot fuses, I think they were. You had to light those and then climb down out of that. And then after the blast, you were hoping no ladders got knocked out so you could climb back up there. That was really one of the dangerous jobs at raising. And I know times that I went up after a blast and the doggone covering was... We used to cover up one side, the ladder road side, with cribbing. Before we went down, after we were all charged up, we'd take 3-4 cribbing and place it over the ladder, your ladder road, so any dirt there wouldn't be coming down when you were climbing back up after the fire. Mm-hmm. There's one particular time I remember we were going up with a rock raise, and I didn't think it looked too good, but it looked like some stubs of cribbing in the rock pile, you know, when it came down, blast. Anyway, I climbed up there and got up on top of the last round of cribbing, and you got a toe hold on the side, and I give the back a tap with a no hole, come down a big slab. Luck, lady luck with you.
Mm-hmm. How close were you to where the rock fell down then?
Well, right there. I just had a toehold on the side, maybe a foot room, and just watch, and then I reach up there and tap that, and it's loose, you know, from the blast, it loosened up. The blast all went down, but at the same time, the force, a lot of times, you're around loose in the head of that little tube. You always got to trim down good after your blast.
Trim down meaning?
I mean, bar down loose ore, loose rock, yeah.
Bar down being?
With a steel bar, and you go in and, it's like a pinch bar. You seen the little pinch bars there? Well, different lengths they made those bars there. And you get in there and you get a little pinch in there where you see a crack. Get that a little there and down come whatever, you know.
So you're making sure you had all the loose rock down.
Yeah.
I have the definition on some other tapes, but I'd like to get it on this one also. Definition of cribbing and the back.
Now, the back is always above you. In other words, you put up a set of steel or timber. We used timber when I started. You got two legs, wood legs of steel, and a cap. That's a set of timber. That's a set. And then you put tamarack poles, we used to use mostly because they were strong wood. They take a lot of bend. You put tamarack poles and cedar lagging across that to protect any loose on the back from coming down through and hit you. That's the back. Here's the back up there.
So it's like the ceiling, the rocky ceiling.
That's the back, yeah. And what are the other ones?
Cribbing.
Well, cribbing, you know, I can't remember exactly how long was cribbing, but it seems to me they were about 4 feet. And they were sent down joggled. In other words, they were joggled on surface. Well, we make a length ways here. They'd cut out, make a little cut, and knock this piece out. So that's a joggle, see. So when that come down, they would overlap that joggle.
So maybe a good way for people who can't...
Four of them, make a round. You're round, you keep going up, and you bring it up to a couple of feet of your back.
So maybe a good analogy would be, it's kind of like Lincoln Logs?
Yeah, similar. Yeah, you could call it Lincoln Logs, yeah.
And that was the lining of the rays?
That was the lining. That was with Yeah, that's the walls, all cribbed up, you know, so nothing can squeeze in or fall down. Yeah.
I want to ask you a little bit more about the differences in the detonation methods. You said it was your experience that for the first part of the time that you were mining, it was detonated by fuse?
Fuse, yeah, dry fuse. You used to carry a fuse down in a fuse box, fuse can, we called them. Slung over your shoulder. There's a can about that big. It was lined with some kind of stuff.
Can you give me the dimensions in inches of what the fuse can was?
I suppose the fuse can was about a foot or so across, you know, round. They were round. And in that, and then it had a leather strap that held it shut with a buckle on it. And then they had a rope on that where we slung it over our shoulders to climb up raises or going into a place. Anywhere we were mining. And then that was your dry fuse and caps. They'd make those up in the fuse room on surface. They put a cap on the end of the fuse ready. That's not, this is for dry fuse. And you'd carry them in, and then as you're going in, you'd stop and see if your partner's left a powder bag at the powder house. Each contract had their number on them. The fuse can also had your number on. You picked that up on surface, and if your bag was out there, your powder bag, you fill it up. A box of powder would fit in the bag. You strap that like a pack sack, and carry your explosive in like that. Well, after you drill your cut, we call it drilling a cut. That's drilling all the holes for that particular size rift. Then you put your primer. That's called a primer. The first one is a stick of powder, inch, it used to be inch by eight, inch by six, something like that, dynamite. We put a hole through it. You had to use a brass skewer or wood. They didn't want you using any metal because of a spark. You punch the hole with a powder punch. That's another thing we had, a piece of brass or copper pointed. Oh, like this, but it had a ring on it.
Like a pencil?
Yeah, you poke the hole through dynamite here, and then we used to take it down to this bottom end and fold it back, make a hole on this end and poke it in there. So it hole it could, in case you had to pull back a little bit down there sometimes.
So what you've described to me is you poked a hole through the side of the side
of the dynamite, yeah. And then you put your fuse through that, your cap, and then you brought your cap around to the front end and shoved it up in the end of the dynamite. Or sometimes they take that, run it through, and then they put a slot again on the side of the, instead of coming to the end, they make one on the side. So they run it through there and back through and up into the dynamite.
So am I clear is my understanding correct that the cap, instead of being on the end of the dynamite closest to you, was actually put in
first,
on the end away from you?
That was put in first, too. That primer was put in first on the bottom of the hole, we call it. End of the hole, you'd say, bottom of the hole. And then you put your other dynamite behind that. And then with the dry fuses, you learn that as you worked with a lot of these old-timers, but you learn how to blast proper way of blasting. I got a tip of my tongue a word here too, but anyway, you got cut holes that opens up the blast, mm-hmm. So the other dirt has a place to go, you know, when it breaks. Mm-hmm. Well, time the blast. Yeah, I learned from an old guy there that some people used to cut so much fuse off for each hole. And I never agreed with that. This old timer didn't go along with that either. He left them all 12 feet. And he just cut a little slit in the side. And then you had those lighters. You lit it with a match. And they were like these kids play with in the 4th of July, a lighter. It looked similar to that.
Oh, like a sparkler type?
Sparkler kind of a thing. Well, anyway, what he taught me was he just made a cut in on every fuse in the breast and every hole. And then you time, heat time, I learned the time by lighting. In other words, you went here with the lighter, psh, that caught, psh, 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 all you wanted. Next one, next one, next one, next one, next one, next one.
And then you always had a certain order, so if you say you had like 16 fuses, you would do...
You light 16.
But then you wouldn't necessarily do them all in order from left to right, top to bottom?
No, it's where you want it to open up and where you want it to dirt to come in for best results, for better blast. Yeah.
And that was something that you learned by experience?
You do. You know, mining is a thing too, that a lot of people think you go in the mine. And I think a little bit some of this next generation had the idea they knew all about it, but they claimed at that time 5 years were an experienced man to learn it. Yeah. But then getting back to blasting, and then later went into electric blasting. Now it's electric caps. They were different lengths. And they had milliseconds, and then they went to a number 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 12. They were different length electric caps. Some burn longer. The longer they burn longer, they go off later. The shorter ones go off sooner. That's the way it works with electricity. But you had to place those caps in the right places, too, to do best break. Excuse me, you'll go and break the best.
Was the break always in the same order, or was that a judgment call on your part?
How the ground broke? You mean? Mm-hmm. Well, it was pretty much how you put your caps.
I mean, if you had, say you were setting a grid of 16
holes,
and say the top left was called hole number 1, you went 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, we didn't go like that.
But if you had it set up so that you would go maybe from number 1 to number 16, was it always the same order, like a car fires? You know, it might do 1, 5, 4, 3, 2. Was it always 1, 5, 4, 3, 2, or was it?
Talk about timing that way. No, it was a little different.
Okay.
Like I say, you had a couple of cut holes. right in the center, say this, that rift here. It was real hard ground. We used to put in two sets of cut holes. Even where it was real hard, we'd put... Now, these ain't going straight in. These are this way. So they kind of meet in the 8 feet in there.
Oh.
A V. V cut it was called.
Oh.
V cut. And if it was real, real hard ground, we used to put what they call in the center of the V's, a buster. Just a short one. So that break that, that would give more for these to work with V's. So how you want to set up the bottom V's go first or these V's? This one always went first if you used it. Forget that one now. We're not going to use that one. Ground is that good. So
I want to clarify for a minute, Mr. Bjork, what you're talking about here, because my impression has been, with all people I've talked to, incorrectly, that all the drilling holes went in at a 90 degree angle to the breast, but they didn't, did they?
90 degree to the breast.
Straight in other words.
No, no, okay. Don't go out from
that.
You. Okay. All right, you've got timber. You've got different size timber when we're using wood. Well, the same thing when steel came along, steel sets. You had a, this mining wasn't all just, you had a little bit, you know. If you had a steel set here, if you had a steel set here, that's called rake when it's leaning out like that. That's okay. Rake.
When it's leaning out at the bottom?
It's got to lean out for support. Rake. Wood sets, we always just check the rake. Steel sets are all automatic because they're welded on an angle on top with a plate that you bolt the cap on. But wood timber, those days, I like that wood working too, timber, framing timber. But you put a rake. Well, anyway, when you drill your holes here, it ain't all 90 degrees. You've got to figure this hole going in here, by the time that reaches 8 feet, it's going to be out here to make room for the next set of timber. If you went in with a 90, you wouldn't have room for the next set. You see?
Mm-hmm.
That's the same with a cap. You've got to put them holes in a little angle upwards. So when I come to that 8 feet ahead, there's room for that cap to go up there. And not take too much ground either. You try and gauge that, so you take about right.
Mm-hmm. So on the outside edges of the drift, the charges would be set slightly toward the outside. They angled out as the hole went away from you, right? And
yeah.
Let me get this clear for the people that listen to the tape.
When you're following a set of timber here to blast ahead, yeah, that's a good idea. I forgot about the length. You gotta start your hole here, but you gotta figure about where it's gonna come out 6 feet ahead. You follow that. And it's the same for the cap. And all right, as you come down this, you don't come down hole here. You gotta keep coming down with that rake.
Okay.
You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You gotta keep coming down out here and hold out to make room for the next set. And also on your bottom holes. On your bottom holes. When you're rock drifting on the main line, they put rails and they put ties, rails for the car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you gotta gauge that to drill down so you got room for your ties. If you drill flat, there wouldn't be no room for the ties.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, that makes sense. So instead of actually setting your blasting pattern in a square as you looked at it, it was the square was wider at the bottom, more like
that's
a trapezoid.
Right. That's right.
Now, from front to back, as you're drilling the holes away from you, did all the holes go straight in, or were two pairs of holes designed to converge as they got...
No, okay. None of these. These went in pretty... well, this top one went in a little bit of an angle, I told you up.
Up away from you.
This one a little bit of an angle in, but out a little bit, this way. These. But then you compensated for that difference, back holes. You compensated if that hole went out this way, you might have bring this hole just a little bit in. So that would relieve the end of this hole that's out that far. That's the way it worked out. And then you could move over here now when you come there, more like that. You know. Yeah.
So the pattern of blasting.
And here's it, like I told you about this V-cut. Mm-hmm. What do we do with our V-cut? The double V. Yeah, right here. Yeah, there's a V cut. We always opened up with V. You could either open the bottom or the top. Let them go first. They went together.
Okay.
Or as close as you could light them with fuse. And electric blasting, you put the same number of fuse in it. So they both went pow, that one.
And with a V cut then, did these, the two of these, eventually kind of come together near the back?
In the end, they met.
Okay.
Looking down at the holes, looking down, there's a V hole.
This is tape number two, side number two, of the interview with Glenn Bjork on June 23rd, 1994. And as side number one of this tape ended, we were clarifying that, in fact, there are several different kinds of blasting patterns. And tell me again, if you would, because I think we missed it on the end of the tape, how you would decide which kind of a blasting pattern you would pick.
A lot of it has to do with what type of ground you have. If you had real soft ground with an 8-foot drift, you could probably get away with 10, 12 holes, even with an 8-foot drift. Then again, if it was hard, you might have to use 25 holes. Yeah, more holes to get that, pull that dirt out. Yeah, so it all depended on the ground.
One question I would like to ask also is whether you were using fuses or whether you were using an electrical charge, how much time would elapse from the time you either lit the fuse until it blew or until you threw the switch and it blew?
Well, electric, when you threw the switch, you were going right now. With dry fuse, I remember now, so long ago, the rate of burn on that. But you had plenty of time to get out of your workings. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's providing you didn't cut too short. There were some people got hurt and blasted by cutting too short. They were going to save time, so that blast would go off quick and got trapped. But you leave that full length, 12 feet, it seems to me it was 12 feet because you're drilling a lot of times, 8-foot cut, so it had to be 12.
Mm-hmm.
You had plenty of time to get out, climb down the rays or whatever before the hole started going.
If people would cut their fuses short to save time, was that because they wanted to get more footage?
Yeah, make money hungry. Want to make money. So you figure they're saving time. I know guys have done it, and I know they're here no more, too. They cut too short. Yeah.
Tell me, when you would detonate the dynamite, what did it sound like? What did it feel like? What did it smell like? What did it look like? How long would the smoke last?
Well, the smoke had a smell of its own. It had a smell.
Is there anything that you could compare it to?
Gosh, I wonder if you could say a firecracker. Maybe. But there was different types of powder you used too. There was a Herkimer, Chelomite, and gelatin, different strengths.
Could you spell those three for me, please?
Herkimer, H-E-R-K-O-M-I-T-E, Herkimer. And gelatin, gelamite, is G-E-L-A-M-I-T-E, gelamite. And gelatin, G-E-L-A-T-I-N, gelatin. But that gelatin was the most touchy. That was 80%. Well, I suppose glycerin. You know, that's powerful stuff. Well, thinking back when we were sinking shafts, I always used to open them boxes when they came down 80-90% gelatin. They use gelatin, by the way, too, in wet conditions with a lot of water. Where that Herkimer and that was more of a drier, like sawdust printer, like. And this gelatin, we used to pound them open in boxes with our boots. I kick you? Excuse me. Yeah, I wish to knock them open.
You mentioned before also that the containers for the fuses and the other things that you would use to set the charges, everything was numbered, all the bags were numbered.
Yeah, for your contract numbers, whatever contract you were working, you all had bags and a few scans. And all your tools, everything was numbered for that contract, whatever contract you're working in.
How closely were all the materials for blasting controlled? Did everybody have to sign for them as they changed hands, or were there no records?
Yeah, there was a powder monkey that used to mark up how much powder he got. He marked that up. And, oh gosh, that was a long way. I bet you that was 1,000 feet from any workings,
mm-hmm. or more. And the person responsible was called a powder monkey?
Yeah, powder monkey. He went really in right away to that and opened up, unlocked the doors, and get ready for the miners coming in to get the powder. Mm-hmm. And they load up their bags, and he'd mark it up what kind they took and mm-hmm. what contract took it. And, mm-hmm. But all, like I say, all the tools and everything had your contract number on it. Mm-hmm. And your brass check, we always carry too. Those days we all had brass checks. And now they've done away with that. Everybody had a number on the brass check. If quitting time that number didn't show up on the board, then they begin to wonder where that guy was, see? Mm-hmm. Or they'd go look for him.
Did you ever, in your experience, have a situation where there were people unaccounted for, and what would they do if somebody didn't come up? Your brass check wasn't.
Well, they had pretty much of that is a little bit like you say a buddy system too. I remember one man in Monterey got killed. We were night shift, and he wouldn't come out the shaft. We always congregated at shaft waiting for the cage. But you know him, and you can probably work next to him. Well, where's so and so? It's on him. He should be here. Well, then they send somebody in right away.
Yeah. And then, was the brass check solely to determine attendance? I mean, in terms of who was down and who was up, or was that connected to how you were paid as well?
No, I think that was original meaning for that was to see if you made it out of the mine, I think.
How did you, what kind of a timekeeping system was? Did you punch a clock when you got to
Later on we punched a clock. We had the brass check system for a while at Tilden when I went over there. And then they changed to a punch clock. Mm-hmm. And, I first went to Empire before Tilden. And they had brass check system there yet. And I don't know, I really couldn't tell you what they have now. I don't think they have that anymore.
I'm more concerned with what you had underground.
Anyway. No, that was brass checks.
I'm going to stop.
But I was going to tell you about contract numbers. Your contract number was on all your tools and powder bags, everything. But I remember when Cleveland Cliff took over the Cambria. It was called a Hartford mine, Republic Steel had it. But there was a superintendent went over there called Trosvik when Cliff took it over. And he said, we want tools, saws, axes, chains, picks, shovels, enough for every contract because I know someone's going home. He knew it. But we got to have enough for the men to work with. Yeah.
What would happen if a guy was caught taking a piece of equipment or something home?
Well, working for CCI as long as I have, they went long ways with a man. There were a lot of chances. They gave him a lot of chances before they pulled a noose on him. Yeah, they were good about that. Even drinking. I knew a lot of guys had drinking problems. They gave him chance after chance after chance. More than any other outfit, I'm sure, with them. But they bent their back that way.
Could you tell me how much you remember about wages that you made at different times?
79 cents an hour when I started at the Princeton Mine. I remember miners were making $9-$10 contract mining. That was big pay. Yeah, just thinking.
$9-$10 an hour or a day?
A day. I was making $6 an hour, 79 cents an hour.
What kind of benefits would you get with that wage?
Well, we paid so much a month to CCI for doctor. CCI had doctor in Gwynn. 50 cents you'd pay, take off your paycheck, you get all the pills and medicine and everything else you wanted.
For just you or for your whole family?
Well, for you. Yeah. That's cheap. And they come to your house to see you too, the doctor would, if you're sick.
What was the name of the company doctor at that time? Do you remember by any chance?
Yes, there was Dr. Serbs was one. Dr. Witters was one.
Could you spell their names if you remember?
Dr. Witters, Joe Witters, W-I-T-T-E-R-S, Witters. He was a Dutchman. He was from down below. They came from NEMA. He worked for NEMA Lumber Company. He was doctor for them. And then they come to the Warriors, and he got a job with CCI at the Gwynn place, doctor's office. And then we had a man before that was Dr. Serbs. And he had a rough time in World War II. He was in prison camps. And big man, but he went down to nothing.
So, do you know how to spell his name by any chance?
Serbst. S-E-R-B-S-T, I think it was. Serbst. Yeah.
I'd like to pick back up on the subject of setting the charges and different things like that. Can you tell me how smoky it was and any other effects that you felt from blasting?
Well, I think the biggest thing with myself was now and then you get that powder headache from handling the dynamite. You handle it, that glycerin and that. You get an awful headache sometimes. The old Cousin Jacks used to say, you gotta eat a stick of powder first and then you'll be all right from then on. Well, sure.
Did you ever ask him what it tasted like?
No, I never. I can imagine what it tastes like anyway, wiping it off of my brow. I knew pretty much what it was like, that glycerin. And then you're charging up back all there and that stuff would be running out of the hole and down your neck. You got some awful headache sometimes. Yeah.
Can you describe for me, when you're underground in any of the mines, was it any warmer or cooler in one mine than the other? What was the temperature like? What did it smell like?
Oh, there's a difference. Sure, there's a difference. Yeah, like Cliff Shaftmore is a very cold mine. It's not that deep and lots of air down there in Cliff Shaft. Then you got Matter B, sixth level was cooler, and as you got deeper, it got warmer. And of course, your ventilation was not quite as good, I would say, probably, as it was on the upper level. Princeton mine was a coal, that was only about 500 feet deep. So it depends on the depth you are, you know. Yeah.
Now you mentioned Cliff Shaft. Did you work at Cliff Shaft
also?
No,
I never worked there. Just my grandfather and his brother that was killed there, Adolf.
Did you ever have occasion to put in a dog drift or any of those kinds of things?
Well, sure. Dog raises, dog drift. Yeah.
Why do they call it a dog drift?
A dog drift is a little small hole, just enough room to get through, just about room enough to stand up. It's just a little hole to go from this place to that place. And if you had a kind of bad ground, you'd put up little cribbing sets, little round poles with a cap and few piece of lagging. Most of the time you could go naked drift, you know. Yeah, just a small hole is what it was.
What's a naked drift?
That's with no timber.
No reinforcement?
No reinforcement, yeah. Naked raises too, we go up with naked raises if the ground was permitted. And if it was bad ground, then you had to use cribbing. Yeah.
What color is it underground?
What color is it? It's black. Dark, nighttime.
I mean, as you look around you, what color is the rock? What color is the ore? What color that you could see?
Yeah, you run into a lot of colors in there, too. A lot of pretty colors. A lot of pretty ore, too. Different scenes, red, dark red, light, yellow ochre. Specular hematite, shines, really crimson.
What's specular hematite?
That's more runs in the hard ore, like cliff shaft. That was specular hematite. It's a hard ore, but it really glistens. And it's shiny. We had some of that at the Mather B, you know, but not. And then we had gosh, I forget. I should talk about this every day, I don't remember. But when you ain't talked for quite a while, you forget. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of different colors, many different colors. It's pretty.
How well lit is it underground?
Shaft is a lot of lighting, and on the main line, the main drift, that's lit pretty well. I suppose every 50, 60 feet, I suppose, maybe 100, I don't know. But they got light bulbs all along here. Cross cuts, pretty well lit up. Until you get up in the sub-levels, you got a light or two, but you depend mostly on your headlamp for light. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your headlamp.
Well, they carried it on the belt.
Battery pack on your belt?
Yeah, it was a pack about that wide, about that high, about that thick. It was a storage battery, wet cell.
Can you describe it in inches for me?
Well, I suppose it was about 8 inches high, eight inches, 8'10", and I suppose about 6 inches wide, 8 by 6 by, I suppose, 1.5 inches thick. And then it had clips on there that you, on your main big belt you wore. Had another small belt where you're running through them clips that hung on your side. And then you had electric wire went up to the headlamp.
How much did the battery pack weigh, do you remember?
I don't remember. It wasn't too many pounds. They were not. You knew you had it on there, but it wasn't that all cumbersome.
How long would it last?
Well, a good charge, it'd go 8-hour shift. It'll go an 8-hour shift. Sometimes you'd have to send for another light. Yeah.
Did each man have his own light assigned to him, or what?
Yes, there's another thing. Yeah, on your bicycle, same as your bicycle number, your lamp number was on that too.
Now, did the company provide that, or did you have to pay for your
own? No, the company provided for that. They provided for the lamps, batteries. And,
was the light from the lamp, I mean, how, if you were in an area that had no other lighting source, about how much of an area would your headlamp light?
Well, it would light up a wide area. My gosh, even this, say you're looking in this room here, you could see with 13, 14, 20 feet, you'd light that whole area. And then you had a bright and a dimmer. I suppose that dimmer would go ahead 100 feet or that, the peaking. Yeah, on the bright. Yeah, it was good light.
Was it steady light for the whole 8 hours? Or
well, yes, it was cold 8 hours. Like I said, there was a good charge and the battery was good. It's like a car battery, a poor battery, then they run down. But overall, it was pretty good.
Okay, so when you would complete a shift, what would you do with your battery to put it on charge?
They had a long table up in the dry, as you're coming into the dry, with slots there for each battery. You just drop her in one of them slots. And then the dry man or the lamp man, they had magnetic to open, magnet. You couldn't open it, a person couldn't. You had to push it into a magnet, and that would release that top. Then the top would open up, and then they'd shove it in on a charging rack.
Did you have a numbered slot, or could you put your...
No, you just put them in that cart there. There was a crest put about that high. You don't have to bend down or reach up. You just dropped it in there, and then threw your check in on this side.
So you were just describing me like about 4 feet high?
This table where you put your lamp? Yeah, I suppose.
What else was there in the dry? Can you describe kind of what the dry looked like for anybody who's never been in there?
It was row after row of chains and hooks going up to the ceiling. Each man had his bass check number and had his own chain in the dirty clothes and the clean clothes side. The clean clothes side of the dry, you took your street clothes off, hung them up, and then you went in. Between the shower rooms, you walked into the dirty clothes side. And there's where your digging clothes were hanging, your digging clothes.
What did your digging clothes look like?
They looked like iron ore, dirt. Yeah, it were clean part of the day, and by a few hours they were all clean.
What would you wear to work underground? What were the dirty clothes?
Well, including myself, you'd have long johns on. Yeah. And overall pants. Some wore bib overalls. Boots, hard toe boots. And a hard hat, of course. And miner's lamp. Your dinner pail.
What was usually in your dinner pail?
Well, Millie always made good sandwiches. You know, one of my favorite sandwiches was a bean sandwich. Like leftover pork and beans. Oh, I love that. Good flavor. Juicy. Yeah, she made a lot of good lunch meat out of meatloaf that was left, or what was left a lot of it, you know, from her cooking. Mm-hmm. But she always had homemade bread, of course, in there, and homemade rolls. And, yeah, she cooked and baked lots those years. Mm-hmm. And always an apple or something, orange. Or, mm-hmm. I remember one night, used to bring hard-boiled eggs on or something. Well, quite a bit used to have them. And by the time he got in the shell off, it looked like a chunk of iron ore he was eating. All red, you know, handling with his finger. Off comes the peeling and the whole doggone egg, instead of white, that was all red. Of course, he got his iron in his system. Too, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where did you usually eat lunch underground?
Right in our working place. And we generally try to eat, even if we had to go a little bit sooner or later, in order to make that blast. And that was the opportune time, and you had to wait till the smoke cleared out. So you'd eat while so that could be anywhere from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Yeah.
How long, so you would blast, and then while the smoke was clearing, eat lunch then?
Yeah, when the smoke was going clearing out. And then it was good when you went back in. Then you wet down the pile. You always had to wet the pile down. Because there was a certain amount of dust all the time. They, underground, too, they used to, we went into what they call a water course. Right in the ground. Imagine that deep down there, you know, a couple thousand feet. Where water was trapped from the beginning of time. I remember one crosscut we were driving. I think it was 6,500 crosscut. We were in there a few hundred feet, and we'd hit these water courses every now and then. A bunch of water would come out and dry up, of course. And this one particular day, we drilled our cut and blasted. Well, we drilled our cut and walked out to the switch on the main line. That's a few hundred feet back. And sit down and eat our lunch. This was electric blasting. We let it go, and then we sat down and have our lunch. And about 15 minutes later, here come floating down the ditch, lagging in poles. Oh my gosh, that was a big water there. Yeah, big water. What did I say?
Water course.
Yeah, big water course. Yeah, that much water filled the ditch and the lagging in the poles were floating. And that was big. And I could crawl up in there. We didn't go up there, but I bet that went for maybe a mile. Who knows? A lot of water trapped. Right from the time Earth was formed.
Did you have a real strong sense when you were underground of how long that rock had been there and all that?
Yes, I thought about that a lot of times. Just like I told you about this water course, just think of the time the good Lord made the earth. When it was a turmoil, a lot of water was, I suppose, got trapped, you know, when the earth was forming and cooling. Yeah, I thought about that a lot of times. In fact, we used to kiddle about sometimes after a blast, and we'd clean out the cut, and first time a man ever walked here, which is true, you know. Nobody else walked here, only the good Lord maybe, but otherwise nobody else walked here. But yeah, you know, the funny thing about dynamite too, I get a kick out of some of these shows when they show how easy it goes off. I don't know how we must have got in a hurry that day, but we had about 25 holes in the lock drift and cross cut. And we loaded the holes and hooked up our wires, hooked it up to the main lead wire, went out to the main line, threw the switch, blasted. I was on the loader that day, the Conway loader, it was an electric loader. We didn't have scrapers on the level because you could use these other types of loading machines, see, EMCO loader or Conway loader. But I was loading out the cut and it was just about cleaned out the cut and the bucket got teeth on it. And when I went in and got that load, what on earth is that? It was a powder bag full of dynamite. We brought this bag extra. Forgot it, and it was right by the breast of the lane, and never went off. So there's the thing about dynamite, you don't know. Okay. But there's a thing about it too, if them holes were not working right, you might have rifled out the hole and really set that off. But the holes all worked good, they lifted, see? All the holes in the bottom hole lifted, and the bag was all intact with the straps and everything on it. That's funny, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say a lot of times I get a kick out of dynamite. People talk about dynamite and stuff. Stands a lot, then again, I suppose you can't sometimes. Mm-hmm. Depends on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned a Conway loader that would do the same job as a scraper. How is a Conway different from a scraper?
Well, a scraper is like I was telling you, with these tuggers that pulls the dirt in. It scrapes the dirt, actually, you know, a cable pulling it. Or a loader, it has a dipper out front of this machine. This particular one, the Conway loader, had, well, it's hard to explain, they have clutches there that when you pull handles, there's a chain down on both sides of the dipper from the machine. And when you lift those handles, you could lift it up one and I would throw the dipper that way, lift one and throw the dipper that way. Or you lift both and up would come the dipper. And as it come up, you would throw onto a belt. And this belt would take this dirt into a car. And the EMCO loader was a little different. That was an air loader. But the same principle, but that wasn't quite as good a machine as the other one. It was I don't know, a little more dangerous, I thought, too. There have been some fellas got hurt on the ground, I think, Monterey, with a big EMCO 4140 loader. They're top heavy, more or less. They tip, see? Tip off the side. Operator got pinned in between the set and the machine. This Conway was lower built and more stable, I always thought, this electric one. And had long reach, you could reach all the way out there to get your corners cleaned after a blast. And you could tip the dipper down and make room for your ties. Have to get all cleaned up. You tip it and you go along and clean up and put the ties in ready. And then they had to put a 5-foot track section in. And then when you got 6 sections in, as you go, track team will come in and take all the 6 sections out and pile them up on the side. And then a 30-foot length to go in there. A full 30. Every 6 sets, you call them and they come down and put 30 feet of permanent track. Yeah. Yeah, it was good over there, Conway.
That information about the putting in shorter lengths and then replacing it with longer lengths is
new. Yeah, there were track sections. There were 5-foot sections. And you put the ties down for a 5-foot section, and then they had fish plates too on each track. You know how track looks shaped, mm-hmm. eh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not bolted. You bolted that on it was just a temporary setup. You put them in and spike it, a couple spikes just to hold that section. And then when you had 6 of those in there, well then the track crew would come down. Well, they were day shift all the time. They come down and take the sections out, with miners help them, and then put in a 30-foot length of rail. permanent. Put it on grade and everything, you know. You know what amazed me too, talking about grade? I was telling you about with that rock drift crew at the Mather A coming toward the Mather B. And when we hauled that through, my partner and I, at the Mather B into the Mather A, that was quite a piece of engineering in that. It was 2 miles or better, that drift. And it hit right on elevation. There wasn't one drift going here, one up here. Right on. And this way too. Right on. But they had to keep an accurate check on it. Even the miners, they had, every time they put a set, they had to put lines. They draw, engineers would put spads up there, and you had to drop lines, sight on about 3 different ones to keep it go straight. Yeah, quite a bit of mining. A lot of things.